Talk Eagle of 1490 AM WLCX Lacrosse. 1490. And streaming everywhere on the Civic Media app.
ABC News, I'm Chuck Sievertson. The owner of the Dolly cargo ship, whose crew said they lost power before crashing into the Baltimore Highway Bridge, has filed a federal lawsuit denying responsibility for the accident that led to the collapse of the span. The company wants limited liability as far as how much it would be forced to pay. This update from Maryland Governor Wes Moore.
The work is moving. The mission continues.
A New York judge expands the gag order on Donald Trump in his hush money trial, saying he cannot publicly talk about potential witnesses or the families of the judge or the district attorney, but he is not barred from talk about those two officials. Mr. Trump has put up the $175 million bond required for appealing his New York financial fraud case. A Los Angeles-based insurance company is covering it. A federal judge in California has denied all eight of Hunter Biden's motions to dismiss his nine-count tax indictment, paving the way for a June 20th trial. This is ABC News.
Local radio for you and your community. It's Civic Media's mission with stations across Wisconsin. Find your favorites at civicmedia.us.
Civic Media News. I'm Terry Bell. Here's what Wisconsin needs to know. Donald Trump campaigns in Wisconsin Tuesday night. His national press secretary won't say whether the former president will announce any political endorsements in Green Bay. Caroline Levitt tells WISN-TV's Upfront that Trump will unveil his agenda. Both Trump and President Biden have already clinched their party's nominations. The Wisconsin primary is also Tuesday. Children in Wisconsin from low-income homes will get nutritious food this summer. Wisconsin will take part in the federal Summer Electronic Benefit Transfer Program. Qualifying families will get preloaded debit cards to use to buy groceries.
We've got families with low incomes, most of them working, by the way, but just not able to put that extra meal on the table for kids who are at home during the summer months.
Shelley Fortner is with the Hunger Task Force of La Crosse. I'm Terry Bell, and this is Civic Media News.
The Todd Albaugh Show.
Former state senator and majority leader in the state senate, Dale Schultz.
Legislators aren't doing their job. But what I would ask all the listeners is, have you taken stock in your legislator? Do they really deserve to be there? Do they really want to be there? In a polite way, ask them to come and share a vision, listen to you, and say we want regular communication. And I think if we do that, the system will serve us very well.
The Todd Albaugh Show. Weekdays, noon till 2. On your local Civic Media radio station and on the app.
You're listening to The Eagle, WLCX, Lacrosse's home for Nightlight with Pete Schwabba.
It's time for The Rick Smith Show. Now, here is the voice of the working class, Rick Smith.
And welcome, brothers, sisters, working class heroes. This is The Rick Smith Show. Thanks so much for being here. Today on the big program, lots to get to. Lots to talk about. Hope everyone had a healthy, happy holiday. Easter, the time when Christians across the globe celebrate the resurrection of Christ. And for me, the idea of rebirth, the idea of committing to being better, to doing better, a new life, if you will, a new opportunity, a new start, if you will. And the same weekend where we're celebrating those ideals, I come across a leak from the Texas Democratic Party. They put out a memo and a video of Texas Republicans attending this meeting with some pretty unsavory characters, in my view, talking about how they're going to jail and possibly murder women who have abortions, that they want to make the death penalty for this, for people who have abortions and in vitro fertilization. This idea that we're gonna hold them accountable for the born and the preborn, and well, I guess the preborn, because ultimately you know where this is going. Their claim that the Plan B pill. And look, I don't claim to know everything about Plan B, but I know it's not an abortion pill. That's their belief and their claim now. And eventually you're going to see this trickle down to all forms of birth control. And I've been saying this for a while. Look, they want to criminalize
women doing what they want with their bodies. They want to criminalize contraception. They want to criminalize behavior that they don't believe in. And it got me to thinking over the weekend, since I did see it over a religious weekend, from a party that touts its religiosity. What does the conservative worldview look like? What would it look like if we lived in a nation where these people actually run the entire country and get to pass the kind of really regressive, punitive, penalizing kind of laws that they talk to each other about? What kind of a world would we be in if we had the Christian Sharia law that they are trying to implement? And it seems to me to be a very dark, dangerous place. Because, of course, they're going to ensure that women cannot control their destiny because, well, you should be in the kitchen. And, of course, they're going to go after all of the LGBT community because, of course, they should be in the closet. And then minorities, of course, because they're, well, they're second class. They should be in the fields anyway. This kind of superiority, this kind of religious nationalism, this is frightening stuff. And it's real. And to have that come out over a religious weekend where these people are generally front and center saying, hey, look at us and how wonderful we are. It kind of got me thinking about, what does that world look like? Because look, I grew up in the Catholic Church. We learned about peace and social justice. We learned about a Jesus that hung out with the least among us, took care of, fed the hungry, healed the sick, spent time with the downtrodden and the outcasts. We seem, well, not us, a certain group of us in this country seem to want to criminalize all of that stuff. So all of the people that Jesus spent his time preaching to and getting to follow him, they'd be all in jail. I would argue Jesus would probably find himself in conservative world jail because it's not about the teachings of Christ. It's not about being a Christian. It's about fire and brimstone, eye for an eye, tooth for a tooth. It's about that fire and brimstone and, well, holding those women accountable. Now, them, not so much. And that's what I have. My mind goes into this hypocrisy. Because while they're preaching how religious they are, they're using the powers of our government in the places where they control to attack child labor laws, to attack women's rights, to attack workers' rights, to attack, well, the homeless. Let's talk about kicking someone when they're down. You know, in April, the Supreme Court is going to hear this case, Grant Pass versus Johnson. And in Grant's Pass versus Johnson, they're basically, they criminalized homelessness. The community of Grant's Pass said, hey, if you got a sleeping bag or a pillow and you're in the park and you're laying down, that's camping, that's against the law, we're going to fine you and eventually throw you in jail. And look, when the Supreme Court hears this case could reshape how cities and municipalities deal with homelessness and how they treat the homeless. My mind keeps going in this place of, you know, if you are unfortunate enough to find yourself in a situation where you have nowhere to live, should you just show up at the local police department and surrender? I look at what communities have done across this country. I mean, the one I live in, they tried to put partitions on the park benches. And I think in a lot of places they did, so that homeless people couldn't lie down. They put spikes on walls that once people could sit on and commingle around. Now there's spikes there because we don't want the homeless to loiter and hang out. And we've defunded programs that would actually help. So it seems to me in this holiday of rebirth, it seems to me in this kind of moment of what would Jesus do now that he's back? I don't think it's all of this. And I know we're in this red hat, blue hat world. I know we're, you know, if Democrats are for the homeless, Republicans have to be against it. I get it. But there's just something called being decent, being a reasonable human being. If you're not going to follow the golden rule, of do unto others as you would want them to do. At least follow the silver rule of don't do bad things to people that you wouldn't want them to do to you. And yet the people who tell us they're wearing Jesus there on their sleeve, they're doing some horrible stuff. And they want to criminalize abortions. They want to criminalize contraception. They want women back in the kitchen, desperate at the will and the whim of their man. And I got to tell you, I find it deplorable, but predictable. And in this moment of rebirth, and in this moment of new beginnings, what will we do? How will we act? Will we stand up for the downtrodden, for the least among us, for the hungry, for the poor, for the desperate? Will we fight for them? Or will we allow a Supreme Court to say, no, you are criminals for being poor? I want to hear your thoughts. Email me, Rick at therickSmithshow.com. Going to take a quick break. When we come back, my friend Pat LaMarche, a homeless advocate, is going to be here to share some thoughts on this Grants Pass case. And you know, maybe are we criminalizing poverty? Back after this.
We are AFGE, the American Federation of Government Employees. We represent 700,000 federal and D.C. government workers who are the vital threads of the fabric of American life. We support our nation's military. We take care of our nation's veterans. We protect our nation's borders. We respond to our nation's crises and natural disasters. We provide services to our nation's seniors. The American Federation of Government Employees. We work for America.
We are AFGE, the American Federation of Government Employees. We represent 700,000 federal and D.C. government workers who are the vital threads of the fabric of American life. We support our nation's military. We take care of our nation's veterans. We protect our nation's borders. We respond to our nation's crises and natural disasters. We provide services to our nation's seniors. The American Federation of Government Employees. We work for America.
Welcome back to the Rick Smith Show. Now, here is Rick Smith.
So I come back to the question, what does the conservative worldview look like if you hit a bit of misfortune? What happens to people if they get sick, lose a job, or heaven forbid, just born poor with no support system, with no family to help back you up? What does that look like? Especially if you're in a hostile community. What does that look like? What if I'm homeless? Should I just immediately turn myself into the police so that I don't have to incur fines and harassment and, well, the kind of nonsense we're seeing going on? Here to share some thoughts on that, I've asked our good friend Pat LaMarche to come talk with us. He's an author, homelessness awareness advocate, and a journalist over at the Bucks County Beacon. You do know here in April, a case before the Supreme Court going to be heard on this Grants Pass versus Johnson, which could, if gone the wrong way, could make me just have to go to the police and turn myself in. Pat, thanks for taking time for us.
I think that's brilliant. Well, thanks for having me. I actually got my press pass Friday. I'll be in the oral arguments for Johnson versus Grants Pass. Gloria Johnson, it's class action on behalf of six people. Gloria Johnson, I believe it's six, is the lead name. Another young woman who filed in the class action died. Because when you're experiencing homelessness, you have a much shorter lifespan. And they tried to get the case thrown out because one of the plaintiffs died. That's how sweet these people are. But the Ninth Circuit saved the case and it's going forward.
So as I understand it, the Ninth Circuit has decided that this rule, this law passed by this grant pass community is cruel and unusual. So the burden now is on Grants Pass, the defendant in this, to convince this Supreme Court, which I got to tell you, I don't have a lot of faith in, but
yeah.
This does say that the lower courts ruled that homelessness isn't a crime, right?
Well, what was happening was they ruled that if you couldn't enforce a rule like theirs, if the person had nowhere to go. So the 9th District basically invented a new category of homelessness, which irritates me too, but it's okay, called involuntary homelessness. Implying, you know, that there's so much voluntary homelessness out there that if you were involuntarily homeless and you had nowhere to go, that Grants Pass could not fine you for having a pillow, a blanket, a piece of cardboard. They use these determining factors to say that you're proving your intention to sleep outside or in your car because you had a pillow. So you proved your intention. So, you know, if you just drink too much and fall asleep on the park on your way home from your frat party and then get up and walk the rest of the way, you didn't bring your pillow, so it wasn't an intention, I guess. I don't know what they're thinking because it's so unkind and cruel.
So if I get this right, as long as I'm homeless with no possessions,
right?
As long as I'm completely, completely indigent with nothing, then it's okay. But the second I start going, you know, I might need a toothbrush and I might need, I don't know, somewhere to lay my head, then that's the crime?
So, yeah, you got to use the curbing for your pillow, I guess, except I don't know this Grants Pass very well, so I don't know if they'd still find a way to do it to you if you had absolutely nothing in your pockets, nothing, you know, your wallet, that's it. But the 9th Circuit said, no, if people have nowhere to go, you don't have a right to hassle them. And the bill is crazy. I mean, the rule is crazy. You get fined if you are found out with a pillow or a blanket or something. You get fined multiple times. I think it's 3. Then you get banished from the city, right? So you can't come back in the city until you pay your fines. And if you come back in the city, that's when you've committed a crime. So by returning to the city, Romeo is banished. I mean, I haven't heard this since Shakespeare. You know, you've got to get out of the city. Yeah, it's absolutely absurd. And they want to go. I'm excited to sit there and hear this argument about why this sort of cruelty makes sense to the dear people of Grants Pass.
Well, I mean, I guess it's not surprising given just how much harassment and intimidation you the homeless community does get. I mean, you know, I've seen stories all across this country that they've passed ordinances that you can't feed the homeless. There's one group, I think it's in Houston, that they're fined every single day for, it's been forever, but just for the idea of handing someone who might be hungry a sandwich, that in a world where we're told, in a country where we're told we're a Christian nation, just seems, well, I don't know, anti-Christian?
Yeah. Well, I think, I don't know any religion, actually, Hindu, Muslim, any, Judaism, I don't know of any religion that doesn't have do unto others as you would have them do unto you. That's like the fundamental premise of every religion in the world. And I don't think this is doing unto people the way you'd like to be done to. And, you know, you were saying something really valuable, and that's that if there's nobody there to help you. Well, the problem with being financially disadvantaged is you come from other people who are financially disadvantaged. So if you've got 3 little kids and you get sick, I just wrote a story recently about a woman whose daughter became so absolutely critically ill, she had to go into the hospital and be put on a feeding tube. Because of that, she couldn't take care of her daughter. Her daughter moved in with the grandmother, and then this woman died. So the child's lost their mom, the grandmother's lost their daughter, and the grandmother is in danger because she can't work her overtime anymore to pay her rent because she needs to be home with a 12-year-old and can't leave her alone 12, 15 hours a day. Because people who are economically disadvantaged live and come from communities that are also economically disadvantaged. There isn't this mythology that you come from the upper middle class and you're just someone who couldn't make it. We have systemic poverty. That's where these people come from. And if some woman says, I'll take in my daughter with her 3 kids, her landlord evicts her. He rented her a 1-bedroom apartment. Now there's 5 people living in there. Get out. You know, so you can't help your own kids.
Yeah. No, and one of the things that I learned, you know, obviously you've been doing this for a very long time, and in the years that I've known you, a lot of things that you've shared with me is surprising. Like the thing that I think most people don't know, a majority of homeless people actually have jobs.
Oh, absolutely, yeah, that guy flipping your burger can't afford to live anywhere. So bon appetit. Hopefully he washed his hands when he got to work because he's got no water or soap or, you know, I mean, as you hear this about people don't want to open bathrooms. Maine right now has got a municipality that doesn't want public restrooms. Florida is going to arrest you if you lay down. They do that all the time. Half of California had until very recently, had no lie down policies. You know, Skid Row, you couldn't lay down. You're going to arrest all of Skid Row? I love what you said about just turn yourself into the police. And by the way, this isn't the police's job. And it's really expensive to incarcerate or even go through this court process with all of these people. It's punitive. It's punishing. Cruelty is the point. There is nothing good about it.
No, that's just something I say all the time. The cruelty is the point. But, you know, I was being serious about turning yourself into the police. Because clearly, if you have nowhere to go, if you have nowhere to stay, and you've now made it illegal, now aren't you saying, look, okay, we surrender. Do with us whatever you're going to do, but make sure that we've got a roof over our head and three meals we can eat. Maybe that's if this goes the wrong way, that's the protest.
Yeah, but that's, they don't want to feed them and house them. But, you know, it brings up an interesting story. I was doing a homeless book tour and I was staying and visiting with people in the Blackfeet Reservation, in Montana. And on the reservation that we went to, the community was lamenting the closing of the jail. Now, communities don't generally lament the closing of the jail, but they were lamenting the closing of the jail because, by the way, Montana gets very cold. And what they had been doing was they had been using the jail as a warming center for people in the on the reservation that had nowhere to go. Poverty on Blackfeet Reservation is, you know, astronomical. And they were just trying to get enough money to reopen the jail so that people could be warm. I mean, literally, this is the United States of America, the wealthiest nation on earth. We should be ashamed of ourselves. I could tell a story every hour from now until 20 years from now to make us ashamed of ourselves. If people would just listen to them, we could fix this problem.
But, you know, here's the thing. You know, everyone that I talk to, oh, they have sympathy for the homeless, but we never seem to do much. And it's always not in my community.
Well, that's because, and I think that's fear. And I can give a certain amount I have a certain amount of patience for people who are afraid if they would admit that they're afraid. One of the most horrifying things about homelessness is that it can happen to you. And I think prior to the pandemic, it was 25% of Americans are one paycheck away. Now it's 40%. So the thing that's frightening is I have to believe that those people asked for it, because if I think this could happen to me, I can't sleep at night. So I don't deserve it. Somebody must deserve it when it happens to them. And that's the only way you can see. So if that's your fear, I hear you and I honor your fear, but you can't let your fear make your choices. And you got to be courageous about this because your neighbors are hurting. Your neighbors are hurting. And that's why we do the Memorial Blanket Project, which is hashtag Memorial Blanket, memorialblanket.org, where we give blankets to people. So I'm especially upset at Grants Pass for making my blankets a sign of criminality, right? If we give a blanket to someone who's cold and living on the street, it will now in Grants Pass, if they get their way, be a sign that that person is a criminal. Because someone made him a handmade blanket. I can even say these words out loud and not think you're in some sort of alternate universe.
I can't believe we're in this place. But, you know, what do you say to the person? Because I've read a lot of conservative thought on this. Well, you know, we're not doing better with policy. It's unhealthy for them to be living in the park. It's unsightly. It brings down property values. It sends all the wrong. All of those conservative arguments. What do you say to those?
Provide funding for housing. They're not in the park because they're in a statue competition to see who can look like one. They're in the park because they have nowhere to go. We don't fund housing. And when you look at the money that goes into housing and urban development, very, very little of it goes to low-income housing. A lot of it goes to things like Jared Kushner got a crap ton of money to build big fancy and renovate big fancy buildings in New York City. They think all the HUD money goes to the poor, but it doesn't. So I'll allocate more funding. We haven't built any public housing in something like 40 years. Why is there a problem of homelessness? Because people have nowhere to live. It's the simplest problem of all to fix. Throw money at it. It is the one thing that you can fix by throwing money at it.
No, and look, we learned that during the pandemic. I mean, you know, we brought down childhood poverty in half by just giving a meager sum of money to parents to be able to put food on the table. And then in the most cruel way possible, ripped it away at Christmas. Right. So it seems to me that you know, there's a segment of the population not in favor of doing that.
Right. Well, I mean, if you're a capitalist and you think, I want to be able to work my way to the top and do really well, great. I'm all for that. But you've misunderstood capitalism in a functioning society that is tempered by social justice. Because you go ahead, you chase that great big shiny apple because you had a great education and you won the birth lottery, as you like to say, and you managed to get what you needed to survive in the society. But make sure that the people who didn't have your advantages don't live in the street, don't go hungry, are educated, don't fall prey to, I mean, crime rates are down all across the country. That reason is because poverty's down. The crime rates in the years of that child credit were some of the lowest because poverty causes crime. It's a poor investment in our country to turn our backs on each other. It's just a bad way to run a society.
No, it is. And look, there's the other way of looking at this, and that's just radical self-interest. That it could happen to any one of us. And look, when we used to do Hungry and Homeless for the holiday events, where we stayed in a supermarket parking lot for a week and a half. We did that, I think, 4 or 5 years. The people that we met who were homeless were not the stereotypical, what you're led to believe, you know, people who were just wanted to be there, who had drug and alcohol problems. No, a lot of these people suffered from mental health issues, and a lot of them just had bad luck. Lost jobs, car repairs, caused a job loss, caused a housing loss, and there they were. It didn't, for me, ring to what I was led, what I either was led to believe or society told me to believe, what was the homeless crisis. It was actually just people who were struggling. And yeah. That, to me, goes in my radical self-interest. I would like there to be a safety net for if and when that ever happens to me.
Yeah. Yeah, and I think it's really important to realize that the people you can see, the people who are sleeping outside right now, the people that HUD counts when they count the homeless, they're the people who are so desperate now they have nowhere else to go. They have no way to hide, or they're so sick they can't hide, or they're so sick they don't care if they hide. But the people who can hide, they lie to you, and I don't blame them. Sure, you can give me a ride home from work. Just drop me off at the corner. I'll walk the rest of the way. Because they don't have anywhere to get dropped off. But they still work with you. They don't want you to know their private business. And why should they, right? So you've got all of these people. You want to say it's drug and alcohol and mental illness? Sure, I can take you to a house and show you a drug addict. I can take you and show you an alcoholic. And I can take you and show you someone with mental illness. The only difference between them and somebody who lives on the street is money. It's all poverty. Poverty is the cause of homelessness. And that's the only cause. Period.
So getting back to this Supreme Court case, obviously you're going to come back and share some thoughts on how the hearing goes and clearly when the decision pops. What are you expecting going into this? What are you expecting to hear during the oral arguments?
Well, you know, if these guys think of themselves as constitutionalists or whatever they call themselves, the new justices that seem to be loving to keep throwing the wooden shoe into the machine, you know, to sabotage the way the country runs. I think maybe they'll find on the side of the people experiencing homelessness, because a constitutionalist would say, hey, look, you want to go out in the woods there and live in the woods? More power to you. That's how the West was won. That's how we stole the land from the Indians in the first place. You know, the constitutionalist is going to say, sure, George Washington stormed towards Pittsburgh, even though we promised the French we wouldn't and the Indians, right? So if somebody just taken up space to live, that's kind of the way the United States government and the country started. So maybe they'll side with the people experiencing homelessness.
Now, I hope you're right, but I got to tell you, given the fact that the Ninth Circuit did side with the homeless, even though, as you pointed out, they created a new kind of category, I just think the Supreme Court taking it is a bad message. But I hope, as always, when I make these bad predictions, I hope I'm wrong.
The best thing about it if the Supreme Court decides the way we want them to, Ron DeSantis is going to have to drop his bill to criminalize homelessness. And that's going to be sweet.
And all of these other places that have then gone after this. And then maybe we start going after some of these other ordinances, like putting, dividers on park benches so people don't have the audacity to lay down. Another one of my pet peeves. But, Pat, I appreciate the time. I look forward to talking to you again as this continues.
I appreciate you, Rick. Thanks for the time.
Thanks so much, our good friend Pat LaMarche. I want to hear your thoughts. Email me, rick@thericksmithshow.com. Should we criminalize homelessness? And if they do, the overcrowding situation could get worse. Or better yet, the for-profit prisons will certainly have their 90% occupancy contract fulfilled? Email me, rick@thericksmithshow.com. Right back after this.
You're listening to the Talk of Lacrosse, Eagle 1490 AM.
I'm meteorologist Mace Michaels. Cloudy sky with showers around for tonight into tomorrow morning. Some mixed snow possible, low 30s. Still some rain showers tomorrow afternoon, high in the mid 40s. More rain and snow mixed as we look on into Wednesday. Windy with highs into the low 40s. Currently, it's 37.
This message is for Shauna, my mom, who just finished her high school diploma. I wanted to say I'm so proud of you for finishing school. You taught me it's never too late to achieve your dreams. I hope to make you as proud as you have made me.
When you graduate, they graduate. Finish your high school diploma for you and for them. Visit finishyourdiploma.org to find free and supportive adult education centers near you. Brought to you by the Dollar General Literacy Foundation and the Ad Council.
Welcome back to the Rick Smith Show. Now, here is Rick Smith.
So, lots of stories coming out about the Francis Scott Key Bridge collapse. And, you know, one of the ones that caught my attention is the container, the shipping container company. Limited liability insurance, so may not be, we the taxpayer is going to pick up a bunch of that. But sadly, six workers did die in this tragedy. And here to share some thoughts on, who, what, how, all of this, and maybe how we keep workers safe in the future, I've asked Jordan Barab to come talk with us, former acting assistant secretary and deputy assistant secretary of labor for OSHA during the Obama years. Jordan, thanks for taking time for us.
Glad to be here, Rick.
So let's start with the incident itself. You know, I've been seeing reports of, you know, that the people who were in charge of the bridge, the people who were supposed to keep everything, you know, safe and on the up and up. This is one of the things, a container ship hitting the bridge was one of the things that they never planned for. That seems surprising to me.
Yeah, well, I mean, from what I've read, and of course, you know, it's all still coming out and will continue to come out for the next several months, if not years. This bridge was 50 years old, and they had built what's known as dolphins, you know, to kind of deflect ships from hitting the bridge or damaging the bridge. But again, it's 50 years old. Ships were much smaller then, and it really wasn't built anywhere near the capacity that was needed for a ship of this size to hit it, you know, straight on, like happened here. So that's going to have to be something they're going to look at. They're going to be looking at bridges all over the country now to make sure they can withstand, you know, especially the older bridges, to make sure they can withstand a hit from a cargo ship this size.
Yeah, I mean, but on the other side, it's something you go, are you that bad of a driver? Or maybe you shouldn't be driving something this big, which is why I think a lot of my conspiratorial red hat friends were going, this is a terror attack. and look, you know, the folks who were, they're still telling me this was terrorism. The Chinese did this or the Russians or Joe Biden. I don't know. But there are a lot of right wing conspiracies out there about, you know, how this was done on purpose.
Yeah, well, there's also conspiracy theories that this was due to DEI and the open border. I mean, any possible, you know, thing they can use in this tragedy to throw against Biden, no matter how little sense it makes, they're throwing out there. So it's getting to the point of ridiculousness. But I think, you know, this is, you know, like almost any industrial disaster. I think, you know, what they'll find is there are multiple problems here. I mean, one is, you know, why did the ship lose propulsion? You know, and there were some signs that the ship had had problems before. Again, as we just mentioned, you know, why wasn't the bridge built or fixed in order to withstand a hit of this size, given how old the bridge was?
Yeah.
So there are a lot of legitimate, you know, major problems here that are going to have to be dealt with without dealing with all the conspiracy theories.
Yeah, my immediate take on it was I guarantee we're going to find in the next several months that inspections were pencil whipped, preventative maintenance was pencil whipped, and that, because you just said it, that they've had problems in the past that could have been fixed early on. I mean, much like the East Palestine disaster. We see this pursuit of profit over people, this pursuit of profit over safety. We see this time and again. So I think that's I hate to use the word safe, but I think that's the safe take on this. This is probably what happened, in my view.
Yeah, anytime you look at these industrial disasters, there's plenty of these that have been analyzed, and you go back and you find it's a string of of problems that led to it, and they all kind of come together at one time. But you know, the underlying theme usually is cutting corners on safety and putting profits before people, and that's probably what we'll find in this case as well.
Now, I want to get your thoughts on the six workers who were killed, because you know, I've been over that bridge. I don't know that you make I don't know that you survive jumping off of it, let alone falling with the bridge on top of you. But yeah. Six workers did lose their lives. Is there something in place for workers to protect them while working on bridges? Is there protocol for communications, for flotation devices? Is there anything that we don't know?
Well, again, we're going to have to see, you know, how this comes out. I mean, basically, though, you know, working on any roadway, whether it's a bridge or a highway, is very dangerous, especially at night. And, you know, I do a column every week called the Weekly Toll, where I list, you know, workers who are killed on the job the previous week, the ones I can find, the ones that are in the paper. And almost a week almost never goes by that, you know, a roadside construction worker isn't killed. Usually at night, working on the roads, gets hit by a car, sometimes a drunk driver, just sometimes a car that just wasn't paying attention. So it's a very common hazard. And these are very hazardous conditions that workers are facing on these highways. So, excuse me. To that extent, it was, you know, nothing new. I mean, people are getting hurt and killed all the time on these. Now, this, of course, in this case, they're working on a bridge, so there's obviously, you know, added dangers there. We don't really know. Again, you know, OSHA's going to, I'm sure, look at this, and the NTSB is going to look at this. It sounds like they were doing everything right. At least they had cones, they had lights, they had backup vehicles in case they got hit, so it would hit the vehicle and not the workers. But they probably hadn't planned on the bridge falling down.
Yeah.
Now, the other issue that comes up is communication, of course, because they knew, it's hard to say, 3-4 minutes, whatever, since the Mayday came in to the time the ship hit the bridge. So there wasn't much time, you know, to get those guys off the ship anyway. Though they did manage to shut down traffic because they had a cop on each end. But there was no communication, good communication to the workers on the bridge. Now, had they communicated with them at the exact same moment they communicated with the officers on both ends of the bridge, you know, maybe they would have had time to get off. And that's certainly something they're going to be looking at from now on, because, you know, obviously, you know, communication in this case was key. Now, I don't know, you know, of any, you know, OSHA regulations, and it's possible there are some that even I don't know about that would have required that kind of communication. But that's certainly something that's going to have to be looked into. Whether it'll become, you know, an OSHA regulation or whether it'll become a best practice. But I'm sure, you know, from now on, there's going to be some efforts to get better communication between the workers and the emergency authorities, especially in cases like this.
Yeah. And look, you know, at the end of this, and this is where you learn from tragedy and hope that you can, you know, mitigate some of the risks in the future. Because, you know, sadly, I don't see any way these workers were not doomed. Because you, as you said, it was only a couple of minutes. By the time they would have gotten to a vehicle, by the time they would have gotten, it would have been late. But you want to try and do everything you can, and communications being the key in this. And it's not surprising me that they didn't have that, or from reporting that I've seen, didn't have any way to communicate with them.
Yeah. And one of the cops said he was going to, you know, he was going to drive out there. And warn them, A, he probably wouldn't have had time, and B, you know, he couldn't go because if he had left his post blocking traffic, then traffic would have come through. So he said he was going to wait until somebody else came to relieve him and then go tell them. But obviously there wasn't enough time for that.
Now, the cleanup of this is going to be, you know, I'm looking at the remains of this bridge going, I don't even know where you begin. This is a worker safety nightmare, isn't it?
Yeah, I mean, they brought in some huge cranes, you know, to start to move the stuff. But first, you know, they've got to cut it into pieces, because even these, you know, huge cranes, I think they've got the biggest crane on the East Coast, biggest maritime crane. But even that can only lift a certain amount. So they're going to have to cut the bridge into pieces that can be lifted out. And in order to do that, you got to have divers down there. And there are some extremely hazardous currents down there. Visibility is terrible, even under the best of conditions. So, and plus they're going to try to, you know, rescue. There's still, I think, four bodies down there they haven't gotten out yet. So they're going to be trying to get those out as well. So there's a lot of, yeah, highly hazardous work that's going to have to go on just to get the bridge, you know, just to get the shipping channel cleared and the pieces of the bridge removed.
Yeah, well, you know, again, I had someone email me say, well, you know, we got to open shipping lines, much like they did in East Palestine, Ohio. Now all eyes are on this. And I clearly, you know, people like you are watching this to ensure that this is done as safely as possible, because I don't think you can do this completely safely. I've never seen this kind of catastrophe before. But thoughts?
Yeah, I mean, there, you know, the Sunshine Bridge, I think in 1980, you know, the one that went from St. Petersburg across the whatever bay that is in Florida, had a similar accident, and they had to, you know, clear that. So, I mean, there's certainly experience in this, but it, you know, the experience and even all the regulations and everything, it's still, you know, it's hazardous work. I don't even know in this case, being as it's out in the water, whether this is Maryland OSHA that's going to be overseeing this or federal OSHA. It's unclear when you get over water, but in any case, obviously they're going to have some, and I'm sure they'll be consulting from federal OSHA, even if Maryland OSHA is handling it. But I'm, you know, there's going to have to be some, you know, very close consultations between OSHA and whatever other safety authorities there are, to make sure, especially that the divers can be safe and you know, aren't going to get injured or killed doing that highly dangerous work.
Especially since there's the pressure of getting this done as quickly as possible. I got to imagine the pressure on these workers to work beyond, you know, is there any hour minimum or maximum requirement? Are there any guidelines for this? Because look, you know, I know here in Pennsylvania, you know, they were working around the clock with that bridge that burnt and it was on camera the whole time.
Yeah.
Are there regulations for divers who are doing this kind of work?
You know, and I'm not real familiar with that, but I know, you know, their time underwater is limited. Even in wetsuits, it's cold down there, you know. Now it's going to start warming up, hopefully. But, yeah, I mean, it's cold down there. It's cold, dark. It's exhausting work. I'm sure they're going to be rotating crews in and out of there fairly frequently, whatever the you know, regulations or guide, you know, safe work practices say.
Yeah. So, and looking at this, to kind of wrap this up, because, you know, obviously this is a worker safety situation as well as a national catastrophe. You know, it's sad that we only talk about worker safety when people die.
Yeah. And, you know, and the other thing is not just talking about worker safety when people die, but in this case, you know, there's been a lot of attention on the fact that these were Hispanic workers, you know, workers who had come to this country to find a better life for themselves and for their families, especially the families they left behind. And, you know, how, you know, important roles they played in their communities. And that's great. I mean, I think it's really important for the media in the country to pay attention to the highly hazardous work that immigrant workers do. And they do, in fact, you know, do the most hazardous work in this country. But it's kind of like people are suddenly discovering that due to this you know, terrible catastrophe. And that's, you know, I mean, again, you know, there's a saying which, you know, kind of turns the stomach a little bit, but, you know, it is don't let a good catastrophe go to waste. You know, and, you know, I think this is useful to point out that it's not just these immigrant workers that are at danger. You know, as I said, I do my list of workers killed in the workplace, and every week there are lots of, you know, Hispanic workers that are killed. They have a very, you know, especially in construction, you know, highway construction. There's a very high rate of injury and death among Hispanic construction workers in this country, and it's been going up quite a bit lately. I think the number of Hispanic workers killed in the workplace, the number of Hispanic workers killed in the workplace only went up 1%, but the number of Hispanic construction workers in 2022 went up by 21%. So not only are these highly dangerous jobs that these immigrant workers and especially Hispanic workers are doing, but it's getting worse. More and more of them are getting hurt and more of them are dying in the workplace. So to a certain extent, the fact that you had Hispanic construction workers killed in this incident is not unusual, but it's because it happens every week in all kinds of different workplaces. But it's good that this country and especially the media is finally paying attention to the important work they do and the important hazardous work they do, and the debt we owe to them to be doing this work that a lot of people don't want to do.
So you said the injury rates are going up for Hispanic workers. Is that because there are more Hispanic workers that are being recognized because maybe we've got immigration that's allowing them to get work permits, being citizens and that sort of stuff? Or is it, finally we're paying attention to it?
Well, I think it's both. I mean, I think that, the rate is certainly going up. The numbers are going up. I think there are more and more, higher percentage of Hispanic workers working in this country. I think in Baltimore, I was just reading, immigrant construction workers make up almost 40% of the workforce in Baltimore. So, as you have more immigrants coming to this country and you have, basically you've got labor shortages, the unemployment rate's very low. American workers can get, better, less dangerous, less taxing jobs. And that leaves, the hardest, most dangerous jobs to the immigrant workers, who have a desperate need to make money, not only for themselves and their communities, but for their families back home. And, that's generally what's happened throughout history is the immigrant workers kind of at the bottom of the, socioeconomic chain are the ones that take on the most dangerous work and the hardest work and the lowest paying work.
Oh, that's the history of America right there.
Yeah. Yeah. But that really is the work that it's hard to use the phrase that makes America great. I mean, these are the people that are, keeping our highways going, putting up our buildings and tearing them down. They're doing all the most, dangerous work out there that, again, a lot of other people don't really want to do. They're working at, meat processing, all the terrible jobs that, American workers, non-immigrants who can find better jobs aren't going to do that.
Right.
And this is not a new story that just happened with this bridge. This is a story that has gone on and is getting worse every year. The useful part, if you can call it that, of this tragedy is it's bringing the work, the important work and the dangerous work that these workers do to the attention of the American people.
The reason I asked the question, and I probably phrased it wrong, is because for the last several years, you've had a lot of injuries that go underreported because of legal status and having, Hispanic workers, working in the dark because, they're questionable status here. And that's benefited employers who get to underreport and, throw people to the curbs. But Georgia,
yeah, that's certainly true. Especially, I mean, it's hard to cover up a death, if somebody gets killed in the workplace. It's not impossible, but usually that'll come to the attention of OSHA and the police and the authorities and get listed. Injuries, it's a different story. I mean, you have all kinds of stories you hear, documented stories and OSHA citations and things like that, where the employer does not report injuries, especially that Hispanic workers and immigrant workers, especially if they're undocumented immigrant workers, suffer. They'll be threatened with their jobs. Or with deportation if they report injuries to OSHA or even to workers' comp, or they'll just be fired if they're injured and sent back to their countries or sent back to their families, whatever. You see these stories over and over again. And again, it's very easy for unscrupulous employers to hide injuries. It's generally considered that injury reporting overall is significantly underreported in this country, but certainly much more underreported for immigrant workers.
Absolutely. Jordan, I appreciate you taking some time for us. No problem. So much for your input.
Okay. No problem, Rick. Good to be here.
Jordan Barab, former acting assistant secretary and deputy assistant secretary of labor for OSHA. I want to hear your thoughts. Email me, rick@thericksmithshow.com. Is there anything we can do to make work safer? Or was this just one of those freak accident tragedies? Email me, rick@thericksmithshow.com. Quick break. Right back. I'm Rick Smith, and this is Labor History in 2. On this day in labor history, the year was 1963. That was the day that the New York Times ran the headline, New York happy as papers return. The longest and largest newspaper strike in the city had ended. During the early 1960s, changes in typesetting technology were transforming how newspapers were made. Members of the International Typographical Union worried the technology would undermine their work. Around 2 in the morning on December 8, 1962, ITU Local 6 called for a strike, demanding improved wages. Members were mostly Irish, Italian, and Jewish men. The newspaper workers at four papers, including the New York Times, walked off the job. Three more major papers feared their workers would join the strike and preemptively locked out their workers. Newspapers were part of the fabric of social life of the Big Apple. In 2009, well-known journalist Nora Ephron described the impact. It was like part of the blood supply of the city was cut off. Funerals in the city saw a dip in attendance as obituaries went unprinted. In all, 17,000 newspaper workers, from typesetters to reporters to elevator operators, participated in the work action. The strike lasted 114 days. 600 million newspapers were not printed. The strike cost newspaper owners $100 million in lost advertising revenue. In the end, the strike was finally settled, and the workers won a wage increase. But they did not win any guarantee against the implementation of new industry technology. A few months after, the newspaper The Daily Mirror closed up shop, blaming the workers and the strike for deepening its existing financial troubles. And not surprisingly, both The Times and The Herald Tribune used the strike as an excuse to double the price of a newspaper from a nickel to a dime.
You're listening to The Rick Smith Show, where working people come to talk.
I'll tell you, it's a horrible tragedy. Six workers lost their lives, and hopefully no one else, no more tragedy in that site. And we get this rebuilt, and we get moving in the right direction, and hopes and prayers with the workers and the families in all of this. But I got to tell you, it's frustrating knowing that the company responsible for this, the container ship company, that they're not going to be held ultimately liable for it. The insurance company's got limited liability, and they're going to be fine. It'll hurt a little bit, but they will be fine. It's all of the other people who are going to suffer. It's going to be we, the taxpayer. And this is corporations getting away with what corporations do. And I'm sure this is something we'll be talking about well into the future. But I do want to, quick before we wrap up, go back to my conversation with Pat LaMarche. Because, you know, after talking with her, my mind went to a gentleman we had met during our food drives. And I alluded to this during our interview. We used to do these events called Hungry and Homeless for the holidays, where we would camp out in a supermarket parking lot. You've seen them in other places. You know, it'll fill the bus. You know, that 30 days in the hole was a big thing with Jerry Shirley in Cleveland. I remember as a teenager, and we would go, and for 10 days we would live in the parking lot, and we would collect food, and we would talk to homeless people, because every night we'd break out the grill and we would feed people. So you had all these homeless people who would come out of the woodwork. You didn't even, during the day, you would never find these folks, but at night they came. Well, because there was food, and it was free, and it was a safe space. And I got to meet and get a much clearer view of what the homeless policy is. And it's interesting. At the time, Pennsylvania had a Democratic governor, and the town I live in had a Republican mayor. Both of them contacted me and basically skewered me for saying a big part of our homeless problem was shutting down the state mental health hospitals. Both of them didn't want that to be the reality. But in my findings, mental illness was a big part of it. Very few cases that I found of people with drug and alcohol problems. Mental illness and bad luck. And one of the stories that will stick with me to the day I die, and I've told this story a number of times over the years. This guy's name was Joe. He was a vet, a Republican, a conservative Republican his entire life. Until, you know, in his 60s, I think he was, in his mid to late 60s, had a heart attack. Had a job, and always had a job, was never unemployed his entire life, never collected a day's unemployment, never needed a handout, never needed anything. This was a guy who, I made it, I pulled myself up, I did all these things, had a heart attack. And after X amount of time, his job just said, well, we're letting you go. We're going to give it to someone else. So he lost his job, no more hours. Ultimately, end up losing his apartment because no money. And in the process of losing his house or his apartment, he had another health setback where he went into the hospital for a couple of weeks. And in that time, you know, friends, acquaintances put money, put his stuff into a storage unit. And eventually the money that they had for that wore out. So here this guy is. Sick. Homeless. Jobless. No car because it was repossessed. No apartment. And oh, by the way, the storage facility that was storing his stuff sold the stuff because he couldn't pay the bill for the storage unit. So basically all around, everything this guy had for his entire life gone. Here he is presented to me in a supermarket parking lot, a 67, 68 year old man, broke, broken, humiliated, and stayed with us the entire 10 days. Had, you know, many, many problems. And I mean, the poor guy just, it breaks my heart. We spent hundreds of thousands of dollars to keep him alive because Medicaid actually worked. He got the care he needed. He got through the heart attack. He got through all of the plethora of other ailments, only to be sent out into the cold, homeless. And the thing that I'll never forget is, you know, on the last day of our event, he thanked us because that, in his words, this is the safest I've been and I've felt in a very long time. Now, we were able to, through some of our contacts, the show paid for a hotel for him to stay in because I felt horrible for a couple of weeks. And ultimately, friends were able to work with the VA to get him a place to stay. And the final months of his life, he was able to have a roof over his head in a VA facility. But had he not had that VA background, he would have died on the street. And I come back to this moment where how we treat the poor, how we treat the downtrodden, how we treat the indigent, how we treat those who are less fortunate, says a lot about who we are as a society. And whether you help the poor because, hey, if it ever happens to me, I want someone to happen to help me. Or if it's because I have a higher calling, some religious calling. Or if it's, you know, I just want to be helpful to my community. We have to do better. And in talking with Pat and learning about this Grants Pass versus Johnson Supreme Court case, I cannot believe that a community would do this. And you go, well, Rick, it comes back down to dollars and cents. It always does. Our priorities are not in the right place. Our priorities are skewed. We spend $1 billion on presidential elections. We spend millions of dollars on Super Bowl commercial ads. There are resources that are being just ridiculously spent instead of, well, again, I guess I'm stuck on this religious theme. But taking care of thy neighbor, love thy neighbor as thyself, helping the poor, the downtrodden. And again, I go back to not just because it's the right thing to do, not just because it's the moral thing to do, not just because, hey, it could happen to me, but because we're better than what we've become. If we're going to present ourselves as the beacon of hope across the globe, shouldn't our backyard look decent? Shouldn't we have our ducks in a row? Shouldn't we treat people with dignity and respect, regardless of their station in life? I want to believe in this moment of coming out of Easter and the idea of resurrection, of rebirth. Maybe we can commit to, I don't know, being better people, being better stewards. It's my thought. Want to hear yours? Email me, rick@thericksmithshow.com. You got a story? I want to hear it. rick@thericksmithshow.com. As always, thanks so much for being here. We'll see you back here next time.
You've been listening to The Rick Smith Show. Email Rick. Email Rick. At rick@thericksmithshow.com. Until next time, this has been The Rick Smith Show, where working people come
soaring high above lacrosse. This is Eagle 1490 AM WLCX Lacrosse and streaming everywhere on the Civic Media app.